Welcome to Iteration, a weekly podcast about programming, development, and design through the lens of amazing books, chapter by chapter. So this week we have part three of Growing Rails, and it's all about building applications at scale. And I am joined, as always, by JP. Hey, JP, how you doing?
Pretty good. So the theme of this final part of this short PDF book is trends. And how can you stand the test of time? And what is a trend and what is an actual thing that's here to stay? Or maybe it is a trend and it's here to stay. I don't know. I think it's going to be a pretty interesting talk that we're going to have.
Yeah, for sure. And I think overall, the whole book, of course, just to remind everybody, this book is called Growing Rails. I forgot the exact subtitle of the book, but it's all about growing sustainable and maintainable web applications. So that can be applied to lots of different things, but it is specifically, a lot of the examples are in Rails, but this week we have a lot of great tips for any web application developer or even software developer out there. And really this last section of the book, and this is a super short book for us, a short season, if you will, is all about building things that last and not moving with the trends and making sure that something is maintainable over the long term. So the first kind of section really talked about fashion and trends and what's cool right now and what's up right now. And so let's talk through that a little bit.
Okay, before we start, what is trending in Rails right now? What's the cool thing in the world of Rails that people are like, you got to do this? Is it GraphQL?
GraphQL, definitely I hear a lot about. It's one of those trending things. I think overall a trend is these pseudo type systems in Rails. A lot of people are talking about moving that direction to where it's something more typed and strongly typed. And it's not, obviously, it's Ruby. It's not strongly typed, but there's this growing trend that I'm just seeing a lot of blog posts, tweets, and things. And I'm tempted to really go into it. And I think it's kind of a good example. And GraphQL is another one. I'm doing an API build out route now. I'm doing it as standard REST application. I was super tempted to do it in GraphQL just because it's the new hotness. It's what's out right now. And I was there is a piece of some of these pros and cons that we'll talk through that are those things. But what do you see as the trends? Did I get them? I don't know.
I don't know. Yes, I think the whole type thing is definitely a thing now, especially with front end stuff, and React isn't typed, but there's all these things like Flow that Facebook made, and there's TypeScript, even though I think Angular was originally, if you make Angular apps, you're probably writing with them with TypeScript. In Rails, I feel like Rails is pretty constant. I don't think there's really anything that's a hot new thing that people are raving about. I think the hot new thing that people are raving about are just service objects, but those are just regular Ruby objects. I don't think there's anything that's really dividing the Rails community right now. Or maybe I just don't know. Maybe I'm just stuck in JavaScript land where everything is in flux.
Yeah. Well, what are the current hot trends in JavaScript? Because you're kind of in that world too, in your day job too.
I don't know, man. I think the whole type thing is very, very we got to do types. We got to use TypeScript. We got to use Flow. I'm not quite sure. I don't know. JavaScript's changed. I think React 16.5 was just released, and I don't think it's changing much. I don't know. There's this whole not really stigma, but there's this thing that people believe that JavaScript is always changing, and every second, from the beginning of the recording of this podcast, 12 new JavaScript frameworks have released, that joke. But I really don't think that JavaScript is changing as much as people think. I think that's just talking heads on the internets, sort of dipping their toes into JavaScript and thinking that it's this crazy thing. But I feel most things are pretty steady, but I could be very misinformed. I could be totally off.
Yeah, I think that if you start owning and really digging into just being really competent and good with vanilla JavaScript, that will go a long way and will be future-proof. I think it's more of a lot of the frameworks and what's the hot framework. It changes really quickly, and a lot of the practices seem to change a lot. Just looking, like you were saying, in Rails, there aren't a lot of trends and new hotnesses out. It's been pretty stable. And I think it's a part of the culture of the community that we really favor, convention over configuration. We favor these tools that are sharp tools, and we go deep on those sharp tools. And it's all those maxisms that are actually maxims that are actually part of the Rails credo, I think kind of keep it stable and a little bit impervious to this trend culture. Where on the JavaScript side, there definitely is like different test frameworks and approaches. And I mean, even all the way from in the little bit of time that I've been doing, you know, full stack development, you know, the past 4 or 5 years, it went from Meteor to Angular to React. That's in the span of 4 years. And those were like there was nothing else to learn when Meteor was hot, nothing else. And when Angular was around, there was nothing else to learn but Angular. And now it's React. And honestly, now it's kind of Vue, at least for the web. You know, React Native is obviously still huge, but on the web, Vue is growing and growing and growing every day. And I keep like looking over the shoulder, like that meme when you're holding hands and looking behind.
Yeah.
Because there's so much of it that seems awesome. But again, I don't want to get caught in these trends or just what's going on right now. So the first thing that the book recommends is when you're implementing or trying out one of these new trends or patterns or a test software or whatever you're trying out, like create a branch and split it, rewrite it the new way, and then compare them. And then you can ask yourself some different questions. JP, you wrote down these questions here. So talk a little bit about comparing the different approaches and the questions we can ask ourselves.
Yeah, so that's like, I didn't even think about that way, but like, yeah, push up a new branch and do like compare against master, and then you can see like the diff. And then ask yourself like, is the code easier to read and change after this like supposed refactor? Okay, and then also ask yourself, did the complexity increase or decrease? And three, did you run into any new issues? And so these are just things that you always have to ask yourself when you're refactoring in general. But in particular, if you're implementing like a new pattern, like let's say for instance, like you just like discovered the like factory pattern or something like that, and you like want to use the factory pattern everywhere, or you just found out about decorators, so all of a sudden like you want to implement decorators in all of your ERB files. Maybe it's not something you should be doing in every single instance where there's an if clause. Just write an if in your ERB. It's okay.
So
it's like, is it easier? Is it more complex? And it's just interesting because I read a lot of this section in the context of like JavaScript, because JavaScript is like always changing, and I couldn't really think of any examples of like how I can apply this into Rails, because these like new there's like new patterns that we've discussed about like really slim controller methods and like how you should structure your models, but I don't really consider those like trends. I think those are just like kind of a, not necessarily best practice, but a method in which you can keep things organized, but not really a trend. It's more of like, here's one way you can organize things.
Sure. I think either way, though, when you're trying something new, you know, breaking your old development patterns, this is a really good practice, and it doesn't take any more time. And I think, in fact, this will encourage me to try more new patterns more often, because I know that I have a systematic approach to it. So I'm going to create that new branch, I'm going to rewrite the feature the new way, or using the new test tool, or whatever different little piece is there. And then I can compare it and ask, is it better? Did the complexity increase or decrease? And did I run into any specific issues? And I think it's awesome. And in fact, like, it'll encourage me to try a little bit here and there, but I just think it's about not rejecting new trends just because they're new or popular. It's about having some sense about it and not just getting caught up in a hype machine and implementing it and trying it and being objective about the new tool or approach.
Yeah. So for me, the first thing I thought about when I was like reading the section about trends is like arrow functions in JavaScript, because with arrow functions in JavaScript, you can like drop the whole function keyword. And if you want to drop the braces, you can just like return implicitly instead of explicitly. But sometimes that gets to be a pain in the ass, because like, let's say you want to throw a debugger in there, or let's say you want to console log, or you want to throw another line. All of a sudden, that implicit return that you're doing with the arrow function, you have to like then re-add the braces back on. And then it's like, is it really worth doing these things just because of like syntax sugar? Maybe not.
Yeah.
So like that sort of addresses the thing of like, did it feel easier to read after the change? Or like, did you run into any issues? Yeah, I kind of did run into issues. Like, this actually becomes a lot harder when I want to like make changes later on. But because it's like the new hip thing to use arrow functions that are like super syntactically sweet, I don't know. That's like one of the things. I think a lot of this goes back to like a pragmatic approach. So like our last season where we talked about just being pragmatic about things, once you discover new fashions, you know, test them out, see what works, see what feels easy, see where you feel like a lot of friction. And when you do feel friction, that's okay. Just like revert to what was working before. Like you don't have to change everything.
Yeah. I really like this one quote that kind of summed up after that kind of pragmatic approach, which is a great way to put it. This quote kind of summed up what is wrong with kind of going through all these different changes and moving with the fashions and getting caught up on the height. And this is the quote, quote, "If you keep changing with trends, your code base will be a patchwork of different styles, making it hard to understand or change," unquote. And I think that's important to remember that you don't want to have inconsistencies across projects or even one project. You want to try to find what works, be sensible about the approaches and tools you're picking, and try to be objective and not just get caught up in the hype. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't be trying and challenging your approach. There's that old quote, which is, you know, have strong opinions, but hold them loosely. And I really like that because I believe that Rails is the best way to build web applications for myself and the types of products that I'm building. And I believe that so strongly. But if I had a different set of facts in front of me, I would move to a different framework very quickly. And I try to be open to that. It might take a little more than a second, but, you know.
Yeah. One thing I like about so far, the advice that we've gone through about organization is that I don't think it's conducive to this idea of different styles everywhere in your code base. Because like, let's say you have an untamed, unwieldy beast of a Rails app that has 300 model files that are just like all in the models folder. So like when you expand in your text editor, it's just like you have to scroll through all the models. You can just start organizing those and scoping them in the way that these authors have suggested. And it's not like all of a sudden your app is very different in many places. It's just sort of like that stepping stone into like beginning to organize your code base, which I think is kind of a cool thing. And so if you start doing that with the controllers as well, it's yes, like your controllers might be different here, like here to there, but it's like a step in the right direction.
Yeah, absolutely. So the next section of this building applications to last was all about surviving upgrades. And specifically it talks about Rails, but I think that we could talk about this in the context of React Native or other things. I know that JP could speak to some of those. And so, you know, the first thing that they talk about is how any dependencies you have in your application increase the cost and hassle of upgrades. Anytime you have different dependencies, and so it's specifically talking about gems in your application. If you're just shoving tons and tons of gems for every little piece in your application, every time that you go to upgrade Rails and get some of those benefits from the upgrade, you have to think about those gems all have to be upgraded too. And sometimes a single gem or a few gems that are really tightly integrated into your application can really hold you back in getting those different benefits from upgrades. And sometimes those can be essential security updates, and you can be kind of stuck because you've got an old gem. And it really comes down to vendors that you're integrating with. You know, I recently did a project with a vendor called TalkBox that like handles and helps with WebRTC stuff. My project is very tied to TalkBox's gem support and React Native support in this project now. And I'm very much in bed with that vendor in sense that there's a lot that I may be tied to. And you have to think really careful about integrating other gems or dependencies into a project that may or may not get updated. And that's something that's really important to think about.
Yeah, so let me ask you this. What is your thought process when you're looking up a gem where you're like, I need a library that does this, and I'm definitely not going to build this functionality myself, at least for now, because someone's probably solved this. But like, what runs through your mind when you're like on rubygems.org or whatever, and you're like looking for the right gem?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So this really runs into the next section of the book, which is all about owning your stack. So let's just kind of dive right into that section. And so the things that really run through my mind is I definitely, unfortunately, look at GitHub stars, even though it's completely meaningless. But the more important thing, the first thing I find myself doing is going over to the commits to see how often are they committing? When was the last commits? Is this really updated often? You know, that's whether it's a gem or some type of JavaScript library that I'm using, whatever that is. And so I always, always look at the commits. And then I also look at the issues. And one of the things that I look for is that not just the maintainer or maintainers are addressing issues, that there's a community that's broader than a single person. So if there's, you know, 5, 6, 8, 100 contributors, I'm a lot more comfortable with moving with a gem than if it's 1 or 2 contributors, a gem or a library. I'm really hesitant to really deeply integrate something that's a single maintainer. Cause like we're all human and the hit by a bus thing, it's like, come on, it's not even reasonable to think about that. Mm-hmm. So those are like the first few things I look at. What do you look at?
Okay. So first I actually ask myself like, what is the likelihood that this gem will break in like 3 years if no one maintains it? Because I was making this foosball app once, basically to like track like who's the best at foosball at my old job. and we wanted to implement like Microsoft's like true skill rankings so that it's like if you beat someone who's like won 20 times and only lost once, if you beat them, obviously your ranking should be like higher because you beat someone who's like very good. But if like you beat someone who's lost every single game, your ranking won't improve that much because obviously they're like a weaker player, right?
That's such an interesting thought experiment. I love that.
Yeah. And so I was like, oh, for sure, there's a gem for this. And obviously there is. And all it does is it's just like an algorithm that it just like looks at players and looks at like their win-loss count. And it also looks at like some standard deviation or something. I don't know. I'm not a math scientist. I'm not a rocket surgeon. But I was like, oh man, this gem hasn't been touched in like 4 years and there's like 5 stars on it and there's like 2 issues or something ridiculous. I don't know, like that. And normally I would like look at those statistics, you know, based off the GitHub stars, right? And I'd be like, I'm not touching this thing. But then I like looked at the code and I looked at like what it was testing and I like, and it's just like, you know, it's not a simple algorithm, right? But it's like an algorithm that probably won't change.
Right. It's written in plain Ruby. There's not a lot of other dependencies in the gem. Okay. That makes a ton of sense.
In fact, it wasn't even like a Rails specific gem. And I think it was just a Ruby gem that imported a bunch of like classes and modules. So like if you're like a very beginner Rails developer and you didn't know how to implement like a gem in your Rails app without it being like Rails G install gem or, you know, like whatever the like Rails generate install device or whatever the hell it is, you would probably would be lost at least for a second. So the first thing I look at is like, is this thing going to change? And then I also do look at like GitHub stars and I look at like when commits were last pushed to master. And then I also look at, believe it or not, I try to look at like what the maintainers are commenting on the issues, if they're like being dicks about things.
Yeah.
Like that, I don't know.
What's community around the gem? I think that, or around the library, I think that's an important piece. Is there a bunch of blog posts on it? Like, is there a bigger community around it? And what's the community like? I think that's really important. And then, of course, I try to look at not only the code, like you said, but that's super important to dig into it, but also just the interface, because there's a lot of gems out there that solve the same thing. Like, there's clearance for authentication and devise, and for a while, I liked the way clearance handled things better, but more and more as I'm building for more scale, I'm liking the way devise is handling things and really liking that library. Again, I said it on the record. I can't believe it. but it's like there's different interfaces to some of these things. And on that subject, I really try to integrate gems when I can beneath a service type interface so that if I had to, I can switch it out for a different gem or write my own code underneath it. And so that is like I'm a little bit less tightly coupled to the gem. Like if a gem requires itself to be called, I try to not do so in a model or a controller. I try to do it wrapped in some type of a service object so that if I had to switch it out with even my own code or a different gem that does similar functionality, I have an interface and a practice to do it. So I don't feel super tied to it. So that's one little thing that I try to do. And especially with vendor integrations, I really try to tie them into service objects wherever it's absolutely possible. I try to do so.
Yeah, there was another topic that these authors had mentioned about, like, there is also the avenue that you could go down of, like, forking a library and, like, just using that. Like, let's say there's a fix that needs to be, like, let's say there's a bug in a Ruby gem and you just, like, fork it and now you use your fork. They say, like, you know, maybe submit a PR so that it, like, is in the next release. And
I remember like that.
Yeah. Because and that's totally like what should happen. Although sometimes it's not ideal because like sometimes you look at a library and you'll be like, oh, there's like 47 open PRs. Like, how come none of these things are being merged in? And you like look through the PRs and it's like, oh, some of these bug fixes that I've been waiting on are like waiting to be merged. So, I mean, obviously, like that's not ideal all the time. But I have been burned, I guess, in a sense. And this is, okay, so this section is all about like owning your stack, right? So like if you put a dependency in your project, like it's yours now. You have to worry about that. And when on the mobile app for WizTutor, there was this like credit card node module thing, like this credit card light node module. And specifically what we were using it for was like so that when a student checks out and they don't have any credit card information, they could just like input their stuff in this like credit card component. And it was nice because it had all the validation. So like it would tell you whether or not it was an actual credit card, like a valid credit card, and if it had like a valid CVC and all that stuff. But there were like bugs in the main repository. So I had like forked it. I had forked someone else's fork that was like submitted as a PR to like the specific fix that I wanted. And sure enough, I didn't touch that project for like 3 months or something like that. And like when we had to upgrade to the next version of like React Native, sure enough, that fork of a fork was like totally kaput. And I was like, well, now I just have to use like the some other solution. So that was just like an instance of like, well, you really have to own your stack. So if you like fork someone else's fork, now you have to like maintain that gem, that dependency, like that whole code base is essentially like yours now, which is sometimes like great for like a quick solution, like a quick fix. And you're like, oh, everything's all fine and dandy. But as soon as you have to upgrade, whether it's like a very necessary upgrade for like a security update or like something else upgrade, like needed to be updated, which like forced you to update your whole stack, which like seems to happen a lot with React Native, then all of a sudden, all those dependencies that you owned, you have to be like responsible for, which is sometimes fun and sometimes not very fun at all.
Yeah. And on that note, like bringing in dependencies, you want to think hard, you know, about doing that. And one of the things that I recommend is look into your current toolbox, you know, into your current NPM folder, into your current Ruby gems, see what's existing already, see what's in there. And can you use one of your existing tools to solve that job? And sometimes, you know, it's a view helper, you know, instead of trying to find this whole new number validator thing, maybe just write a little Ruby script that does the number validation for you. Whatever those little things are, it can be tempting to just throw a gem in or throw in another NPM module. But sometimes it's 5 lines of JavaScript or 6 lines of Ruby to just accomplish that functionality. And then you own it. Because ultimately, if you are importing something into your code base, now it's in your repo. You own it. It reminds me of that movie with the ship and the boat. And Tom Hanks, and the guy says, I'm the captain now. You know that movie?
I don't.
But like, that's dang what the code says when it comes in your repository. It says, I'm your code now. Like, all of a sudden, you have to like bathe and feed and care for this little baby of code that's in your family of code now. Like, it's yours. Like, it's not like it's theirs. It's in your code base, and you have to maintain it and understand it. We've talked about that in the past, of understanding it, but you also have to maintain it. And I know like a lot of people solve this by like vendoring out all their gems, and so they basically manage their own versions of all their own gems, which is kind of what you were talking about. And I think that there might be a reason to do that at a certain scale, but I think look into your current tool set, whether that's your existing code base or your existing dependencies, and see if you can kind of solve that. And it gave some good examples. Well, I don't know who wrote these down, but they're here, so I'm going to steal them. And it's like, should you use Redis, or can you just use Postgres or use SQL in a more creative way? Or, you know, for a long time, I was doing like sloppy search in a application. And I actually had a pick last week of this Sidekick whole like big, huge dependency that I pulled into this project that has these, you know, all these different fuzzy tables and stuff. But for a long time, that application ran just fine on Postgres fuzzy find. And it was to a lot of scale and a lot of deployment. And so we put off bringing in that extra dependency for a really long time. And I think it was the right solution. Now that the team's a little bit bigger and the scale's there, we needed better search that went deeper and that was even sloppier than fuzzy find can give us. But I think it's important that you look in your existing toolbox instead of just pulling in more dependencies to try to solve it with what you already have.
Yeah. So I have a bullet point here that says I like maxing out your current toolbox first. And I think that's like a very cool idea. So I'm working on this side project with my friend who like owns his own like barbershop, and we're bringing on another developer to help me. And he's like very new to Rails, and I was just introduced to him today. And he asked me, I was like, do you have any questions? And he was basically asking like what the stack is, right? And I was like, it's just vanilla Rails. And what he was getting at is like, so what JavaScript or what front end are we using? And I was like, we're just using vanilla Rails. And I don't know if he took that like, God damn it, I want to like practice my whatever. I want to practice like some front end stuff. And I basically was like on my soapbox about like how I think. I was like, I think we should stretch it as, I think you can get like so far just writing a vanilla Rails app with vanilla JavaScript.
I just love the web, man. It's so stable. It works so good. Give me all the just HTML, old HTML.
You just give me some like JavaScript, you know, some script tags. Let's throw some script tags in. Yeah. Let's do some query selector all, you know, and like, I think it's fine.
So you're preaching the choir.
I told him like we do have, I did put like a React thing in there. So like the React Rails gem is in there. We can write like little React components if you want to sprinkle. If you want to sprinkle in some React sprinkles here and there, but I was basically like, I don't want to have like a whole nother dependency where I have to worry about React Rails, you know, or if I have to worry about React, and if like, you know, all of a sudden like Webpack updates or something, and you know, the hot new JavaScript thing happens and I have to worry about updating it. That's not what I want to do. And if it gets to the point where it's very painful working in vanilla JavaScript and you just can't take it anymore, okay, that's fine. We can start sprinkling in some React. Hopefully, I don't know. I couldn't really gauge what his feelings are over that. I mean, I think he's still like relatively new. He's still learning. But I think there's just like so much you can do with a current, with the basic tools that you're given. It's sort of like if you're like a new snowboarder, you don't need like thousands of dollars of worth of equipment.
Totally.
Now, that's not to say, you know, like you can do fine with just like a rental.
Well, I think it helps you to not over engineer. That's kind of what this whole discussion is. Cause you know, just for this one basic side project that you're doing right now, it's going to be a real application. I know that. But for right now, you'll find those edges that need a more JavaScripty, more modern front end. And then you can bring it in when the time needs it. Cause if you do that now for just your login form, doing this whole React dependencies and all of this shit, it doesn't make any sense to start doing that. Like do it with basic default stack stuff. I love it. I couldn't be more with it. So then the next closing section of this was all about tests. And you know, me and JP will get up on that soapbox about testing. But I loved this metaphor that the whole chapter opened up with, that your project is like a dark house. And think about your project as just a pitch black house. And your tests are like little lights that shine lights around your house. So the more tests you have, the more you can see whether or not there's a monster lurking in the corner or a big hole in the floor or see these types of issues. And I think it's a really, really good metaphor because when you think about it that way, you realize quickly, okay, I don't need 100% test coverage. That's not the goal here. The goal here is to be confident that I can see the whole house inside. They can have a certain amount of confidence that there isn't something gnarly looking around. So you're testing those key areas by shining those lights in those key spots around.
I love those metaphors. Like, is there a big hole in the ground? Is there like a monster in the corner that I don't see? Like, that's like a nice representation of like what bugs are.
Yeah, absolutely.
The one thing I will say about writing tests is that I think, especially like at open listings, because we're like very, not test first, but like you have to ship with tests, is that like it lets you ship frequently. And like with confidence, like you know, to some degree of confidence, because obviously not, you know, no one's perfect and, you know, things can get past QA and there will like be bugs that will surface because you didn't, no one accounted for it, like some random edge case, but at least you can cover your base cases and the edge cases that you can think of and like not like worry about, you know, the whole world exploding.
Yeah, absolutely. I talked to a little bit about their approaches and how they recommend testing. And it was very DHH-y to me in the way that they approached it, which was, you know, unit tests when they're really valuable and when there's something complex on your model to test because they're really performant and it makes a lot of sense. But then in general, they lean really highly on full stack integration tests, like a full feature. So like log in as this user, click here, click there, update that, move there, just to make sure everything works together cleanly. And that's very much my ethos and approach to testing. Like I don't really have necessarily, and everybody calls these things different tests, whether they're integration or controller tests, system tests. Yeah, there's a lot of different things to call them. But I think that we all understand like testing single methods or single functions and then kind of testing them all together in the main golden pass that you need to make sure. Or where you've had bugs in the past, make sure you write tests against those bugs when you're refactoring them. And then you've got the coverage to make sure you're not exposed to that bug again. Because that's something that I find that oftentimes if you aren't writing tests against a bug, you will write that bug back into the system. You have kind of paths that are bug prone, I find. And doing that full kind of feature test helps prevent those bug prone paths.
Yeah, I'm going to steal a metaphor that my friend Zach was talking about in the context of this app we're working on together, but it works for tests. And so to me, integration testing is like, let's say you need to paint a wall. Integration testing is like getting your roller, like a big roller brush, and like doing the broad strokes. And unit testing is sort of like the little, you know, the you go a second pass with a finer brush and fix the edges that you couldn't get with
edging,
the roller.
The edging, yeah. I like that. Around the light switches.
Yeah, around the light switches, you know, the little edges that you couldn't quite get with the roller, or you didn't want to because it was going to like roll over some crazy thing that you didn't want to touch. That's sort of how I see testing. You have to have a nice balance of integration and unit tests.
Yeah, I like that. Awesome. Well, that wraps up this book. There was only 3 episodes on this book. It was a super short read. Strong recommend. We'll have the link in the show notes. We don't get any money or anything on this one when you buy it. And we are going to take 1 week off, and then we'll be back with a nice, fat, juicy book that's going to be like 12 or 13 episodes long. So that's going to be exciting to kind of dig into some bigger material. Me and JP have been super swamped, so we did a shorter book here over this little summer section, but we're excited to be back and strong all the way into a new book.
Sweet. Should we go over, do you have a pick for this week?
You know, maybe I don't.
All right, that's cool. I have one.
I'd love to hear it.
Okay, so you know me, I'm like big on productivity apps, like to-do apps, note-taking apps. And I was using for a little bit this app called Todoist. And for me, Todoist is like very average. It's just like another like app. I don't think it was that great. So I ditched it. And I saw someone tweet this app called Notion. I think it's like Notion.so is their website.
I love Notion. It's so cool.
Okay, yeah. So I started using it as like my, it's like taken over everything for me. So it's like my note-taking app. It's my to-do app. It's like my, I'm working on a current ticket in the sprint, and it has like all my things there. You can have like Kanban boards in it. You can have like dedicated pages. It's like very cool, and it's like very clean. It has like this, it's almost like, it looks almost like a native macOS app, like something that Apple would make.
It's very macOS, yeah. The thing about it is I love Notion. I've been using it a lot with my team. And so if you imagine a Google Sheet, but in like a million different formats, and you can like see it by card, see it by rows, like view one row, but view detail of that. And it has full markdown support. There's so much about it that's so fucking cool. And I've really been digging it. I don't use it for my tasks specifically, but yeah. So I will double pick your pick because
nice.
It's super awesome. You do have to start paying for it pretty quick. Like,
oh, really?
Yeah. Which I totally am down for. Like, they've got to pay to run it somehow. They're not Google. And it's totally affordable. I think I pay $5 a month for it, and I don't mind paying for it. But you can use it a lot for free and do a lot. But once you start combining other people, like I've got team members in there, and they're submitting stuff, then you have to start paying, which it's like, totally, you're developing this thing. It's awesome. But has there any other tips or tricks you found in it that you really dig that you want to share?
I just like it because you can also, like markdown, like you could have like code snippets. So typically what I do when I take notes, excuse me, for code is I'll like make a repository and like just upload it to GitHub. But I was like, maybe I can just take notes in this thing for the, like the books I read, or like, you know, if I want to, you know, take notes on some Swift things, I can just like, you know, write little snippets in there and not have to like create a new repository every time I do that.
For sure.
I just liked it because it felt like it was made for developers for some reason. I don't know. Maybe it wasn't, but it definitely feels like it's catered to me.
I love these new, there's a couple of these out. There's Airtable, Dropbox, Paper, Notion, and they're very much these like open-ended workspaces where you can view things in whatever format you like and create new views to them. And it's kind of a, like Google Sheets meets Evernote, but like not either. It's super cool. And there's a lot of them out there. And I love this new trend. And I think it's really, really powerful. And at some point, I think you'll start putting software developers out of business, honestly, because you'll be able to wire up like these awesome interfaces and like to run your company on. I think that it makes sense. I'm all for it. I think it's awesome.
Yeah, all the software developers will flock to those companies.
Yeah, probably. All right, well, that's all for this week. We will see you guys in 2 weeks. Thank you so much for listening. We love it when you guys reach out on Twitter. It's super fun. If you have your own thoughts on the episodes, we will for sure retweet you and hit you up on Twitter. So that's awesome. We love to see you guys over there. And I guess that's it. We'll catch you guys next time.
All right, thanks so much for listening. Talk to you guys next in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
See ya.